So, folks, Finn is a permaculturist and permaculture teacher, and you bleed permaculture. maybe that's how we describe you.
Okay.
And because something like that, two interviews we've done, I've picked up two from you, that permaculture is something that you're applying throughout your life.
Yeah.
And believe that is something that can be and should be applied throughout our lives.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about should. For me, it makes a lot of sense, which is why I do. I guess it's the framework or the philosophy and kind of action framework that most strongly resonates with me and allows me to take meaningful action in the world and kind of helps me make decisions.
Yeah.
So that's why I guess I'm so passionate about it. Because I just find it very, very useful. But I don't know if there's a should in there.
Yeah, no, that just came out of my mouth, as things tend to when you've got a microphone in front of you. You can't have silence. So with the first two sessions we did, you talked about the big picture of permaculture and the origins of permaculture. Mm. Now we want to get into, it's called the permaculture flower, which is a conceptual thing.
Yep.
And tell us about that, because I really don't know too much that I could talk for long about it.
So... again, just to step back for a quick minute, is in essence, permaculture has, like, I guess, a fuck-a-papa that, as I shared before, goes back to, or at least can be attributed most clearly to, a man named Bill Mollison and another man named David Holmgren. And most people, I think, in the world's exposure to permaculture has come through Bill Mollison.
Yeah,
and they worked quite collaboratively in developing Permaculture One. The permaculture flower emerges out of the thinking and writing of David Holmgren, and that was out of a text. It was first published in 2003.
What was that book?
That's called Permaculture: Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability.
I think I've seen that. Yeah. So Bill Mollison was kind of the guy who was out there telling the world about it.
That's
and
right.
Gathering enthusiasm, and David was the guy in the background beavering away at. Maybe that's a bit unfair, but... Yeah,
but there's an element of that.
Yeah, just getting right into the detail and the philosophy.
And so, one of the interesting things to say about Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability is the use of the word beyond sustainability. That was at a time when sustainability as a word, well, from my point of view anyway, had a lot more currency than it does today. And
it was already in the process of being overused, though, I feel.
On the edge of, yeah. But it, whereas the word resilience... didn't really mean much to too many people. And so he's really talking about resilience in lots of ways in that book about how do you design for, implement, and maintain resilient living systems.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that appeals to me about the permaculture flower is it's a more holistic way of, I guess, thinking about many different components that make up for, you know, quote unquote, sustainable living, or, you know, a holistic way of thinking about one's environment, one's culture, one's society that isn't just about, you know, kind of growing food or planting trees.
Because, and that's the thing is what we were saying before, is people think about it as a form of gardening or agriculture at its most simplest level, but you're definitely telling me it's more than that.
It is, yeah. And so,
and in fact, originally they'd say it was a design system. Anyway.
Yeah, but it was focused originally on food, so it definitely has fuck-a-papa in food production.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the flower is a seven-petal flower, and so each petal represents a domain.
Yes.
And today I want to do a deeper dive into the land and nature stewardship domain, which permaculture is probably most associated with.
Can we say what the other ones are, other domains?
Yep, so there is building. Which largely refers to, I guess, the built environment, as I'd call it. You know, all the largely the stuff we create. You know, the roads, the infrastructure we build, as well as the buildings. There's tools and technology, education and culture, which in some ways is arguably a better place to start because I think all of it emerges from there. But we'll get to that in time. Health and spiritual well-being, finance and economics. And land tenure and community governance. And I think we'll probably pick that up last.
Yeah, and we'll work out how permaculture works with those, because immediately you announce some of those and the intrigue is there, like, okay, how's that going to work?
Good.
But we're not going to do that, folks. You're going to have to wait quite a while for some of them, actually. But so today, let's get into it.
Yeah, so I think we should start with land and nature stewardship, because, again, it's most associated with with permaculture. So one of the things I'm also interested in doing as we explore each of these petals is to look at how they're expressed here in Whangaroa.
Okay, yeah.
So I guess starting with the nature stewardship, and we're really talking about te taiao here. And so, to my mind, we're thinking about all living systems, which include our own life support systems, you know, those things that nurture and sustain us. You know, we have come a long way as a species to starting to think about ourselves as separate and distinct from the living world. But, a whole range of contemporary issues, challenges, and insights have reminded us that we are, in fact, very much a part of the living world.
Yes, and then we were talking about that earlier, and even that was part of the discussion with Lisa, like the effect it's having on our rates, just to get into a council detail.
That's it.
Yeah.
And so how do we prioritize and protect and enhance those life support systems so that, again, they can do their role and allow us to enjoy a certain quality of life? And so probably in the Whangaroa context, arguably anyway, and I guess from a life principle, is starting with why is probably a good place to start.
Why?
Yeah. So
the Māori why or the English why?
The Māori why.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. And so, water as a basis for all life is what are the things that we do to protect and enhance, te mana o te wai.
And we put fluoride in it.
Well, so these are...
Sorry, I'm sidetracking the interview.
No. But I guess, so there are a range of things that we do today to maintain a degree of complexity and, I guess, kind of... We use industrial processes, right? But if we are thinking maybe more a grassroots or more an ecosystem point of view, is, when we're thinking about why, so taking a step back is you talked about fluorinating water. So, we are talking about drinking water, but more generally, we're talking about things like streams. We're talking about estuaries. We're talking about wetlands. We're, of course, talking about the harbor. We're also talking about our springs. So how are we looking after and caring for those things? And our coastlines. And there's a whole range of initiatives in this place that address specifically, why. I've heard some, beautiful stories told over the years. And, there's obviously a long, rich history. Māori knew the need to look after and protect why as a core principle. And I think industrial humans have kind of forgot that a bit. But having said that, there's been lots and lots of actions, even in kind of recent history in Whangaroa around that. So one, things like extreme come to mind. And in terms of, at least the stories I've heard from Matua Rick around going and talking with Eva Rickard and saying, I want to clean up the harbor. What can I do? And her kind of pointing her finger up the hill and going, go sort out the dump.
Yeah.
And so...
Because there were, Eva and her daughter Angelina had taken photos of the old dump site, which I've seen. And because it was an unregulated site, like there often wasn't a person at the gate. So people would come from Hamilton to dump really toxic crap that you weren't allowed to dump. So it was an issue.
Yeah. And so that there's a whole initiative that emerged out of the desire to look after the harbor.
Yeah.
And, it was kind of like, yep, that's great that you're a marine biologist. But actually what we need to do is we need to go onto the land and stop what's flowing into the water, into the harbor, in order to clean it up. We can't even get straight into the harbor to clean up the harbor because it's ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. And so, that's what a 20-plus year initiative that has provided a whole range of capital development for this country or for this area. So in terms of, there's the financial side of it, but there's also the skill development, the job creation, the changing the mentality about people's thinking about, waste and waste minimization, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that initially, at its core, was an intention, as I understand it anyway, was about environmental stewardship. It was about how do we look after the harbor.
Yeah. And like permaculture, then it immediately overlapped into community and
development,
economic.
That's exactly right.
And, all the social stuff. Yeah.
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 And so we have things like Whangaroa Harbour Care and the good work of Fred and, others in that space.
Yeah.
And, I'm guessing, but the tens of thousands of trees maybe that have been planted
More than that. Yeah, that probably got to tens of thousands in the first couple of years.
Yeah, I'd say.
And that's a guess though, but I would Fred may even ring us if he's listening to tell us.
But you know, many. All that good work over all those years, and again, a focus on how do we clean up the harbor, and what do we do there to ensure? Well, again, we go kind of back onto the land, and we look at our waterways, and we look at our streams, our estuaries, and how do we recloak them, and how do we revegetate them? So that's, you know, another one of those, I guess, key initiatives. And then there's a whole bunch of things that the Whangaroa Environment Centre do as well that's really focused on nature stewardship and really looking at how do we look after te tāiao. And then there's a whole bunch of other things that are happening at smaller scale in terms of, you know, farmers planting out their riparian zones, you know, regardless of whether they flow directly into the harbour or not.
They all do eventually.
Yep, they all will. That's true. But I guess, yeah, whether they have a direct tributary that feeds in or not.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, whether it's obvious, you know,
when
you're standing next to the stream where it goes or not. Yeah.
And, you know, then there's the Nahere component, I guess, of nature stewardship. And when we're thinking about that, I guess one of the things that's interesting for me often around the I think the word is etymology, but the origins of words. And, you know, Nahere, as I understand it, is directly translated is about many connections. And so the forest was seen as this place of connection. And because of its complexity, it provided so many different connections that its name became Many Connections as a reference.
Interesting. Because we think of a forest in English, in modern English, or in our culture, a forest is has connotations of a place of confusion and you don't want to get lost in the forest.
No, that's
true. It's a metaphor for things going badly awry, which is it's completely different, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. So, it is interesting to think about those comparisons about what words mean. But
that was quite stark, I realize now. Yeah.
And so when we're thinking about Nahere, all the different nurseries, you know, so the work of Fred and Whangaroa Harbour Care, what, you know, Chloe and others are doing out at the Kokiri and the nursery out there and the amazing trees that they're growing on site and, again, making available for local reforestation, local planting projects. There is Karioi Nursery out in Whale Bay, again, providing good quality native plant stock. And so there's all these different initiatives that have that support the community and support te tāiao in terms of recloaking, reforesting, revegetating, stopping erosion, doing all those amazing things. This is all just part of, you know, what communities have done forever in terms of looking after the land. And so there's a lot of the stuff that's alive and well here in Whangaroa.
Yeah. Yeah, and we can see, I think it helps that we can see around the town, you can see the natural world. Sometimes in the middle of Auckland, you can't even see the land. Mm. It's covered in stuff.
Yeah, and the patches are so small that they're not deemed as significant, you know, we probably only recognize a Nahere as one if it's of a certain size or scale.
Well, yeah, that's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. A small park doesn't count, really. Lacks the complexity.
And then I think, you know, there might be something to being able to look out at Karioi and, you know, and see that beautiful cloak that she's covered in forest. And then, of course, there's things like Karioi Project and all the good work they do. And then there's a whole bunch of neighborhood scale initiatives around environmental care groups. So trapping, you know, we're setting up in our small valley a pest control kind of network, you know, so there's the elements of trying to look after, say, you know, native birds, but there's also, you know, farms around. And so when stoats come through, they decimate poultry as well. You know, we've got ducks and we've got chickens. And so it's in everyone's interest to, again, looking after those pest plants that come in through and can do, you know, quite a lot of damage.
So for someone who is completely uninitiated, and you had to explain to them what permaculture was and why you were talking about that. Like, what's that connection? I mean, I know probably some people are saying, well, that's obvious, Aaron, but I'm kind of interested in the thought process because David Holmgren especially has obviously done that thought process of why the stuff you've talked about is important and what the point of it is within permaculture.
Yeah, and so I guess one of the reasons we started where we did with this particular pedal too is it makes sense to me is that basic idea of humans cannot thrive in a degraded environment. We need to look after and care for the living world around us in order for it to be able to provide for us. And so there's a reciprocal relationship there. And if permaculture is about designing resilient and abundant communities, you know, kind of at a high level, then that requires us to get back into relationship with our living world again and to take an active role, that kind of that stewardship. You know, Māori understand this deeply through concepts of kaitiakitanga. Mm. You know, that there's a reciprocal obligation. And, well, many Māori that I know and work with would see that as a reciprocal obligation that is part of their whakapapa. You know, there's a commitment that has been made that's passed down through generation to generation, whereas, you know, a lot of us don't necessarily have that same deep connection to place where we maybe feel it in our bones. Some of us might.
And here I am from the modern culture. I want you to explain it, something that for other cultures is just inherent and you don't question. But I guess it comes back to like permaculture is conjunction of two words with the word permanent in it. So if we
culture.
Yeah, if we want to have a permanent culture, a permanent agriculture, then we have to work with the natural systems.
Yeah.
And then it goes from there, it flows down into this particular
domain
or petal.
One of the thoughts that comes to mind is, and this is kind of an area of interest and inquiry for me, but as I'm learning more and more about the Maramataka and trying to align my life to the Māori, I guess, lunar and celestial calendar, is this fascinating idea for me about built into the lunar cycle is the idea of give back days.
Yeah.
And so these days that are recognized as being opportunities for stewardship to actively support nature to do all the things that nature needs to do. And you know, if you imagine there's, what, three or four give back days per month is, you know, how would that change our lives? How would that change our culture if we had a cultural orientation towards, you know, whatever that is, 10% or more of our month being allocated to active stewardship.
So that's the cycle of the month is you're taking from the natural world, so at some point you're giving back.
Yeah, and working with, I guess, is kind of maybe more as I understand it, but there is a recognition of, you know, that there's a provision there, so there's a harvest. You know, to be alive means to take, as it were. And so how do we give back? And I think that's why, you know, to my mind, you know, really, I don't think one's ecological literacy or one's understanding of how nature works would have to be particularly profound to understand the need for that reciprocal care and stewardship.
So there's something, I latched onto the cyclical approach of that too, because I think there's something about our modern culture which it's not cyclical. Hmm. We're on a linear journey. We're going up and onwards to better things.
Well, we are.
That's the mythology of our culture, but it's linear. Yeah.
The ascent of man.
Yeah, and it's very linear, and you can leave the stuff behind that you've messed up or something. I don't know. That's an implication. Whereas the implication of cyclical is you're returning back to the spot, so you want it to be in good condition when you get back to it.
Yeah, and the more frequently you cycle back, generally the better off. I'll just drop an interesting thought grenade here, just because it feels, or maybe interesting. It's interesting to me anyway. There's a thinker that I quite like named John Michael Greer, and he's looked at the time frames of civilizations, the typical timelines, so between 700 and 1,000 years is the average life cycle of a civilization versus societies, which can last thousands and thousands of years.
Yeah.
And kind of looking at, well, why does that happen? Why are the lifespans of civilizations so much shorter? And his hypothesis, which he calls the Sumerian hypothesis, is that the more we build an artificial environment, the more, I guess, we kind of landscape, or the more we manicure and denurture our immediate landscapes, the less feedback we get on a day-to-day basis. So the less in tune we become with what's happening. And so the lag times of those feedback become longer and longer. And so by the time we realize that our actions are degrading or deleterious to our health and well-being, it's often too late. And so that the crash or the fall is kind of already baked in to the cake. And so I guess flipping that to what we're talking about now is land and nature stewardship reminds us of the benefits of that regular contact with the environment around us and our opportunity to kind of recalibrate and go, is this working? Are the things we're doing, are they supporting the life support systems around us or are they degrading them? And if they're degrading them, let's stop doing that, because opposed to just kind of going, one day we'll get around to it. And, you know, at a national scale, you can certainly look and see what's happening is, you know, our rivers are getting worse and worse. Our soils are getting more and more depleted. And even globally, you know, there's the narrative now of, you know, we have somewhere between 30 and 50 crops left in terms of what industrial agriculture can support. And so, but yet we keep doing what we're doing. So how do we, you know, and again, that's at a global scale, and that gets into other conversations around the superorganism and, you know, global supply chains and all the rest of it. And I do really want to bring this back to kind of here at the bioregional scale and here in our communities, here in our neighborhoods, here in our backyards.
Well, this is where we can be effective.
That's right.
We can feel effective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what I do want to touch base on just briefly before we wrap up is the land part of it. So we've been talking a lot about more of that kind of nature stewardship, but where I think about the land, and it, you know, it's obviously related, but more in that Whenua space, is the recognition that, and there is some why in this as well, but today typically most of our, the things that nurture and sustain us often come from the land. And so we're thinking about food, obviously, but we're also thinking about things like fibers and fuel and medicine. And typically a lot of those come from the Whenua. And so what does land stewardship look like, especially when usually those, to get those things, again, it's a provision function. So we're taking them, I guess, as it were. And so how are we taking them and what are the ways in which we're supporting their renewal and their sustenance, I guess, as it were. And there's lots of, again, great stuff happening here in Whangaroa in that space. And there can always be more, but and I'm aware of, you know, some of the great work that Whangaroa Environment Center, and I think probably others were involved with that I'm less familiar with, but around a piece of work looking at what does food sovereignty look like for Whangaroa, you know?
Yeah, and it was actually quite a sobering thing when they did it. They're like, actually, like our resilience is not that great.
No.
We see a lot of farmland, but they're mostly doing one thing.
Yeah.
Which is what you get in our industrial system.
That's right, in our economic system, because it prioritizes that, so we optimize towards that. And so some of the other things that I think have flown out from that piece of work and just emerged from the community from a grassroots level is things like, you know, there's crop swaps. So there are people who recognize that, well, wait a minute, we don't all need to grow all the same stuff. How about I grow tomatoes? And if you grow potatoes or whatever else it might be. And so, you know, crop swap is, as I understand it, I think a monthly thing.
I read something on someone's blog a long time ago, and it was like, how can I do permaculture on my own postage stamp section? And they were like, then they started clicking, like, because permaculture has its zones, which we haven't talked about. But, you know, the zones, some of the outer zones are outside of your property. And you're saying, and started talking about things like that. Like my neighbors down the road have got lemons. And this is all part of how the system actually works, that I'm not just me on my section trying to do everything.
That's right. And I think, you know, there does make sense in sometimes to specialize and other times to be generalist. So, you know, growing lots of different things is good, but sometimes if we grow more than we need of something, then, you know, crop swap is, you know, that runs into the bowling club is, you know, is one of those really cool initiatives. There's, I should mention Kai Whenua, you know, not around, but I think pioneers in this space for Raglan in terms of, you know, local market gardening and providing really good quality organic kai for this community for a long while.
Yeah.
And I think showing what was possible.
Yeah. Are you mentioning the growers market?
Yeah. Totally.
Just popped into my
head.
And
again, another one of those that's emerged, I think, at least in part through that work and supporting local growers to be able to bring their produce to local consumers. And the more we can join those dots, and it takes pressure off well, there's a whole bunch of things that make sense about it from a land stewardship point of view is, you know, eat local, support local.
And it's providing some infrastructure. Like, it's like, yeah, why would people become market gardeners if it's impossible to get started? And
that's right.
When you're little and it's not your day job, you're not going to send stuff to the market wherever. There must be a market for produce in Hamilton or something. I don't know how that works, where Foursquare gets their stuff from, for instance. But yeah, as a beginner, that's too much. The infrastructure is not for beginner market gardeners.
And I think the other side of that is true to a lesser extent too, is as consumers, when we walk into a supermarket, we expect, you know, our diet does. It reflects what's available in the supermarket. And so how do we at least start thinking about seasonal diets? Because that's, again, part of that land stewardship is we're eating with the seasons. We're eating what's local. We can import stuff, sure. But right now, our diets don't really reflect on the average, on the whole, is what we can actually grow in this area. And there's a whole bunch of implications associated with that when our food comes from somewhere else. There's things like seed saving. And again, Whangaroa Environment Center is playing a role in coordinating some of that. And I've got some friends who are really avid seed savers. And so how do we make sure that the things that grow well here in Whangaroa are saved and then passed on and shared around? And it builds our resilience around that.
And there's for people who don't know, that's a hugely deep area to get into, because each generation of seed becomes better adapted to our area, like the soils and the climate and all of that sort of thing. And that's almost another one of those things that almost was a forgotten art form.
Yeah.
But we used to be so essential.
So essential. And, you know, heirloom, literally.
Didn't every farmer, like, each year select the best plants for their seeds for the next season?
Yep.
Before there was an industrial method of doing that? That's how important that is.
That's exactly right. And, you know, there's a lot of people here who have expertise in that space in Whangaroa, who are sharing their skills, who are sharing seed. And so, so that's, I guess, part of that land stewardship. And then you talked about climate effects, and there's a whole different thing there too around, well, what do we do in a changing climate, and what does good seed look like? So we need people experimenting and doing new things.
How fast can the seed-saving method adapt to the changing climate?
I don't know. I guess time will tell, right? Because some of that is about looking at foods that are, changing diet as well. So that what are there foods that we need to start thinking about growing because we can grow them now and they're more adapted to,
so semi-tropical, tropical plants.
Yeah, and even, you know, wetter, potentially more soil, more moist soils. You know, if we are going to get, you know, if the last six months is anything to go by, is that, I'm not sure that this is the case, but if that's a new normal, then we're going to need to start thinking about growing foods that are much more tolerant of wetter soils. And move to taro and, you know, those kind of...
And genetic diversity is a key to that as well, because if you're looking for the plant that did the best this year to keep its seeds, you want genetic diversity. You don't want a monoculture or monocrop in terms of its... Yeah.
And so there's something interesting in that too, because we're still talking about annual food production, which typically resets the land every year to a starting point. And so how do we start moving and thinking about more perennial systems as well, where we can actually regenerate our forests, whether they're endemic, whether they're native forests or not, and still get a yield from those? And so there's a whole conversation about, you know, how do we ensure that at a minimum our soils are always protected and covered? And then there's things like leaving soils fallow, and there's things, you know, like soil amendments, and we start getting into some really interesting research that's happening now in the regenerative agriculture and agroecology space that's around that land stewardship, as how do we meet our needs from the land in a way that protects them. And I think there's lots of really interesting developments that are happening there, and people in the space who are trying it, you know, whether it's livestock systems or integrated animal systems or annuals or food foresting. But it's all in that space for me about how do we ensure that we're growing food and fiber and fuel and medicine in a way that protects, nurtures, and I guess enhances the land.
Yeah. All right, that's a good place to end on. We've gone past 10 o'clock. Folks, we've been talking to Finn McAsee. It's our permaculture segment. And this was about the permaculture flower petal number one. You probably don't call it petal number one. It doesn't have a rank. But it's the first one we've looked at, and it was land and...
Nature stewardship.
Land and nature stewardship, yeah. All right, Finn, thanks for coming in.